Welcome back. And it was pointed out to me that not everybody knows everybody here. It never occurred to me. So why don't we just take a minute and introduce ourselves? We do have some new members which I'd like to welcome. Mary?
Mary Springer.
Sandy Hurt.
Carol Spagusa.
Patty Marble.
Kathy Guthrie.
Sean Moore.
Irene McGuire.
Carolyn Bailey.
Jen.
And I'm Gary. Okay. Welcome to the new people, too. It's nice to have you.
And
Mary Ellen. I came across something which I had meant to tell you about, and I forgot, so I thought I'd start off with it. We will be talking about Pally's biography, and I mentioned to you that book by Dave Lindorf, Pally and Jung: Meaning of Two Great Minds. There's also a website which is very, very nicely laid out. It's about 10 or 15 panes, P-A-N-E-S, of his life and pictures. And it's one of those long URLs, so I'll pass this around. You can copy it down. Or if you want, there's a link to it on my website on that page, Folio. So you go to jgsparks.net, click on Folio, and then it says Wolfgang Pally in Modern Physics. You can click on that either way. So I'll pass this around. You can... there was a there was an exhibit at the remember the Iteha, remember those letters? There was an exhibit, the Iteha, I think about 5 years ago. It must have been his 100th birthday, which would have been 2000. And they kept that exhibit up on the web, so you can read it in about 10 minutes, and you get a feeling for the whole expanse of his life. Just so we all understand what we're doing, I didn't write this material. Does everyone understand that? I just translated it. I meant to bring the book along in the German book, which was written by... Did I mention anything about the writer? The guy who wrote it is a Dutch physicist. And must be a young guy, like 40s or something like that. And... I came across it just by accident. He went to the archives at the Iteha, and the other big center of Pally material is at what's called CERN, C-E-R-N. You might have heard of that. It's the big nuclear physics research center in Geneva. And I think they've got the biggest cyclotron in Europe. There was a big to-do when they built it. You might have read the news ages ago where part of it's in Switzerland and part of it's in France. It's underground. So this guy, Van Erkelenz, went to the archives in Zurich at the ETH and went to the archives in Geneva at CERN. And went through all the correspondences, all the notes that are there, and dug up 40 dreams that are the 40 dreams we'll be working with that had never been published. So one of his great contributions is he just did a lot of digging around in archives looking for dreams and came up with these 40-odd some. And I got the book and I read it and I thought, this is some of the most brilliant interpretations I have ever heard. I don't want to sound like a snob or either sound stupid, but after 20 some years of working, I couldn't have done this. How in the world did a physicist with no psychological training come up with such accurate interpretations? So apparently then what he did, he collected the dreams and he interpreted them, and I think this might have been his doctoral thesis, which was then subsequently published in German, which I have translated. But in his foreword, and I have corresponded with him since, he acknowledges in the foreword, and he acknowledged in the email, that he discussed many of these dreams with von Franz. Oh, that's where it came from. So he credits her. He credits her in, I think, either the foreword or the afterword. He also discussed the dreams with two other people. One I don't know. The other you will probably know of. You know the artist Peter Burkhäuser.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
His daughter is an analyst. She must be about my age. And he credits her on the cover of the book as one of the people he collaborated with. So it's really a collaboration. And I don't know how much of the work is his, but when I was reading those interpretations, I just thought, this is the best Jungian work out there, or this is among the best Jungian work. And sure enough, it must be the work of von Franz that he was inspired by or assimilated. So that's how this book came to be. He got an idea to research, find the dreams. He found the dreams. He went to von Franz with the dreams. They discussed them. He also discussed them with Burkhäuser's daughter, who's also, I think, very, very good. She'd be one of those people I would think would be among the top of my profession, and in terms of ability. And then with those conversations, wrote this book. And I discovered the book by accident, and that's how I came to translate it.
Exactly.
By synchronicity. By synchronicity. So again, what I plan to do is pass these on to a couple of publishers as we're talking about them, and hopefully not get caught doing this, and then have the publisher write to him and say, we want to publish it, can it be translated? I can't imagine he'll say no, and then they'll have the translation. I've shown it to some people, and people think it's pretty decent, but I still want to get other opinions before we actually try to submit it to him to say, this is what we consider a translation. So we're kind of going through the back door, but if it all ends well, we'll be all right. Let's see, review. The big point I made was that since Pali was one of those whose conscious work played such a role in the history of the 20th century and now the 21st century, in that the physics these people developed first gave rise to the nuclear age and the Cold War, you could say, all of that came out of this work. And it's what opened the door to micro technology, to microelectronics. So the computer, the internet, all of this stuff follows from their probing and unraveling the nature of the atom. Because he was at the center of history, so to speak, almost by accident, his unconscious reacted with corresponding strength. And he worried intensely, consciously and intensely, over the consequences of what his work was doing to the world. And I think because he was consciously absorbed in the effect of his conscious work, the unconscious has responded with images to help heal not just himself, but our time. So we'll be looking at Pali personally, but we will also be looking at how the unconscious is trying to see the way into the future given the nature of the problems of our time. So it will be very much a study of what's going on psychically behind the events of history, and what do we need to know, what do we need to be aware of, that we can make the right decisions. We talked a little bit about the history of physics. We'll keep coming back to that. The big players are Niels Bohr, Wolfgang Pauli, of course, and Werner Heisenberg. Hopefully that all sounds familiar. And that was done in Copenhagen. I would point out a very important quote-unquote coincidence or synchronicity, depending on how you want to see it. At the very same years, these guys were working on the model of the quantum atom, which is 1913 to 1927. are the exact same years Jung was in his Night Sea Journey. So both quantum physics and Jungian psychology were incubated in the exact same 15 years. I don't think it's an accident. I would say that quantum physics is to matter what Jungian psychology is to the psyche. And they both are fundamentally new standpoints. So if you ever get discouraged with the physics that are in the book, do think of the physics as a metaphor. It's a whole new worldview surfacing in several different disciplines. But we will try to build the bridge between the similarities in the shift in paradigm between the two worldviews.
What were those years again?
With quantum physics, it was 1913 to 1927. Maybe I'll take a minute before we start and just go through the history of quantum physics with you. To 1927. And for Jung, it was 13 to 28. 1913 to 1928. And if you think of it, 100 years ago, neither of these professions existed. So two whole new professions, Jungian analysis and quantum physics, were born at the exact same time. If you like to play historic synchronicity, just this is not really relevant to our immediate purposes, but I also often thought that it cannot be an accident that the when the bombs went off in 48, that was the same year that the Nag Hammadi manuscripts were found after being buried for 2,000 years. And who's the main player in Nag Hammadi? Sophia. Nag Hammadi is the Gnostic texts that were found. All the texts, all the information we have about Gnosticism prior to this time is from the church fathers who wrote about Gnosticism secondhand, saying, this is what the Gnostics say and it's wrong. So ironically, they saw to it that we found out what the Gnostics said. But everything we had, including what Jung worked with, was secondhand. It was the church fathers saying this and that. Like tonight, for example, I'll be reading some texts from Gnostics, but it's what the church fathers said the Gnostics were saying. But in 1948, we found, for the first time, the original text of the Gnostics, the same year the bomb went off. And who's the main player in Pauli's dreams? Sophia. So it's like nature somehow at a very deep level has both witnessed destruction and is trying to bring healing, both on the historical scale and in the life of this individual Pauli. And he then also has a paradigm for what we have to go through to wake up. I just think it's an amazing set of coincidences the way that all happened. As I said, what we're going to do is look at Pauli's dreams as a way of understanding how does the unconscious understand we need to change so that we don't blow ourselves up. And the big idea that we're going to be seeing is that our knowledge of the natural world is too small. We have to enlarge our understanding of what matter is and what the processes are that move matter. So a new kind of knowledge seems to be the answer. And what the images will be doing, those of you who do or have done dream work will know, how when an attitude is ready to be made conscious, the dreams symbolize it first in images. Before it's ever clear in your mind, it's in your dreams, and you rack your brains. What does that image mean? What's that image mean? And slowly you will see that image becomes a conscious attitude, and I think that's what we're dealing with here, but on a larger level. We're beginning to see images of what our future level of consciousness will be, although they're very unclear, and we won't really understand it, but we'll begin to try to get a picture of it. Another characteristic, I think, of the future paradigm is that there will no longer be a split between science and religion, or between matter and spirit. You know, pick your duality. Another characteristic of it is, I think, that meaning will replace power. And I know that's a big word. We will be talking about that through the course. So the big problem with science is its power shadow. It says it its main objective is to know, but in fact its main objective is to dominate.
The argument from pure science says no, it's the idea to know. But then science in service to whoever's funding it ends up having power.
Well, Pauli left America because in America there was no difference.
Even back then?
Yep. He was offered a free ride at Princeton, faculty position, probably the equivalent of about $200,000 today, no teaching responsibilities, go to the office, sit around and drink tea. He said, no, thank you. I don't want to be involved in science that is in government and industry oriented. And he said, and that is in fact the way science is. There is no such thing as pure science. Somebody's paying the bills for those laboratories. A big figure that we'll be seeing besides Sophia we talked about is the Stranger. And the Stranger has roots in medieval era as Mercurius. And I brought along some pictures of Mercurius. I've marked them with little thingies. Mercurius is, here you can see he's winged, which would mean he can move between realms. Here he is again. You see between the sun and the moon, meaning he can shift between the world of the conscious and unconscious. He's often hermaphroditic, so he's contains both sexes. Therefore, is a uniter of polarity. There's another thing. He's a man, but he's got breasts. We've got to look at this. We'll be talking much more about, you could say, the history of Mercurius. How did he get from Greece, which is where he was Hermes, to Mercury, which was Rome, to Mercurius, which was medieval? And then what's happened to him? We'll be talking a lot about that. So the two images that we'll be examining and trying to understand what they mean practically. But first we have to understand their nature symbolically as Sophia and Mercurius.
So is the Stranger Mercurius?
A Stranger would be a modern incarnation of Mercurius. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, you can see what Mercurius doesn't stand for divisions. He's what shuttles between divisions. So for him, this idea of spirit and matter is absolutely ridiculous. So the Stranger would be that sense that the world is unitary returning back in a modern garb. And we'll see, the Stranger tells Pauli to do very specific things. This is not some grand fluffy concept. He has specific homework for Pauli, and it's really remarkable to hear what this dream, really what this archetype, I think, because this is the collective unconscious, is asking of us. So the idea is that the unconscious is trying to transmit, so to speak, the knowledge we need to live into the future, putting it as simply as possible. We talked a little bit about Mercurius and Christianity, how there's a problem there. We talked about another, I'm not just giving you sort of the preview of the show, different phrases for the images we're going to be seeing. It's Mercurius, it's Sophia, it's meaning. Another phrase he uses in the very beginning is that we will be examining the numinous background of experience, which is another way of talking about Mercurius. And why is it the background of experience? Because what the point of view that seems to be conveyed in these dreams is that we are sort of exponents of an interior world which is somewhat of a meaningful design. And where do we see it appearing? Well, in synchronicity. So those of you who are either through sheer intelligence or absolute masochism have stayed with all these courses that we have done here, you're going to see every course we've ever studied used in these visions. We will see the numinous background of existence is a reference to number and time. So we'll be drawing on what we studied in number and time. The image of Sophia, we worked on in Aurora. Those of you who did Zarathustra, one of the big dream figures in Pali's dreams, beside the stranger and Sophia, is the Persian. And I've racked my brain about that Persian for the longest time. I'm pretty sure it's Zarathustra. Zarathustra was a Persian. And what did Zarathustra do but come back to heal the split between matter and spirit? That's what we did in the Zarathustra seminars. So we'll see Zarathustra. Your knowledge of Nietzsche will be helpful here if you've done it. The dreams will be filled with alchemical symbols. So what you've learned in the work on Mysterium will be of use for you here. And we will really need to understand how these images are historically conditioned by Western civilization, and therefore you will be able to benefit from your work on Ion. So all of these works that we've studied will come into play here. And I think hopefully you'll begin to see that, gosh, what Jim was talking about wasn't just a bunch of fanciful ideas, but it was an attempt to understand what was going on in the collective unconscious. And most of us aren't carrying big questions like Pauli was questioning, so we don't see this stuff in our dreams. But you see it in people's dreams who are carrying big questions. All this stuff appears, and that's why Jung was working on it. We're going through another shift of paradigm. That's something else I mentioned. Now I'm sort of repeating, but to recast it, we're going through a shift in paradigm from, well, we talked about how our view of time was relativized last time. We'll be looking at other examples. But I liken it to the shift from when we went from thinking the Earth was the center of the universe to the realizing the sun is the center of the universe. It's a parallel shift. And where we are now psychologically is like those people who thought the Earth was the center of the universe. And what we're moving to psychologically is the psychological parallel to feeling that the sun is the center of the universe. That we are not the center, but something else is. And that something else is what's going to be talked about all through these dreams. And just like that was a slow, painful transformation, and that took hundreds of years, that's where we are. We're talking about a change that is going to take several hundred years. And I don't know about you, but being a sensation type, I'm always thinking, oh, right. But history has always had these major shifts. Why would we not be in one now? I think we are. And I think that's what these dreams of Pali are about. Another term we talked about, which we'll be coming back to, is Pauli's dreams accused him of being a scientist whose knowledge was uncommitted. That's the word that's used, that he had uncommitted knowledge. We'll be talking about that too. What does it mean that science apparently doesn't seem to come with any ethical implications?
That was the word, right?
Mm-hmm.
Disconnected as opposed to uncommitted seemed,
Disconnected doesn't have the sense of responsibility.
Well, as in disassociated, I mean, that's a type of disconnect, dissociation.
But committed emphasizes that that the relationship to the object of knowledge carries with it responsibility. And you don't get that with disconnected. That was instantly not my choice. And that's the way it's always been translated. So I just followed in suit, yeah.
Well, you had specified that you actually put the German word there, so I thought you had a question.
Well, that was an accurate. This is one of these words that you don't get easily translated. But I think uncommitted, if you wanted to be precise, you could say detached and uncommitted. But uncommitted means detached, so that's why I stuck with the word. Literally means not tied to. That's what the word means, not tied to knowledge. Verbinden is to bind or to tie, and un is not. So it's a not tied or not connected knowledge.
The condition of not being connected.
But in a feeling way, you see, in a feeling way. And that's why the word, I think, committed carries the idea of the responsibility, which is implied in the feeling of unconnected. Who knows, that may, if he ever reads this, that may be something he quibbles with, I don't know. His English must be pretty good, but probably not good enough to write in English. We'll also be looking at Pauli's personal life, and the problems in science are also to be seen as examples or metaphors. I'm not quite sure what word to use for problems in his own Eros life, which were substantial. It sounds like his first wife was basically a call girl. And that didn't work. And then he married a woman who I think stayed by them. But I was told it was not a fire match. They were friends, good friends. And I think Pauli was not faithful sexually. Well, we got started on his life. He was born in 1900. Dad, a Jew who had immigrated from Prague, who disavowed his Judaism, became Catholic. The split in Pauli's family, with his father being a rational Jew, rational in the sense he thought he could disregard his tradition with a choice. And his mother, who as Austrian was probably closer to the earth, closer to her peasant roots, more natural, gave us the split already in Pauli's personal life of the split between spirit and matter. But, you know, again, that's not to say the split between his parents is what caused him to be dealing with this stuff, but he was gripped by a much larger dynamism of all of Western civilization's problem. And his family was just an example of that. And the split between spirit and matter started with Descartes. He actually took a course in Descartes, if you can believe it. And he says that there are two kinds of things. There are thinking things, and there are extended things. Res cogitans and res extensa. It's Latin. But you could say thinking things and extended things. So you've got your mind, and you've got the world. And that is the assumption of everything in Western civilization and science since, what, 1500s probably? Or if you could say 1600s, maybe he was, I think. Mid-1600s, does that sound right? Don't know. I think roughly. Anyway, a long time ago. And that's what we're reevaluating. We've already seen, leaving out the emotional and the psychological aspect of, we've already seen that breakdown when we look at Einstein's theory of space and time. We realize you can no longer separate the observer and the observation. So just there, that basic premise is collapsing. What's the parallel in psychology? It's what I loathe about clinical psychology. It's the me, docy, you, sicky model. And Jung did everything he could to overturn that. The two people are sitting in a relationship. And there is no such thing as objectivity. There's the attempt to become aware of your subjectivity. But you can see how this idea of subject and object is breaking down. We're going to be watching that all course the whole time we're here. And that's where we stopped. Does that sound all right? The other thing we talked about was Einstein. Does everyone basically get that? Time is relative. Space is relative. Could you explain it to your grandkids? No. But you think you got the basic idea? Okay. I don't wish you to stumble over these physical details. But I would mention that, as I said, that they are metaphors. So you're not just learning about cold science. See, that's already our prejudice, that subject and object are different things. Oh, psychology is interesting because it's about people, but physics is boring because it's about stuff. What we're going to see is that stuff is, the way we conceive of that stuff is a reflection of the way we conceive of ourselves. So science is as much a metaphor as is mythology. And to that extent, don't be freaked out by the physics discussions, because we'll get into them today. You know, math isn't important, but just the basic ideas. How space and time don't seem to be objective in movement that is approaching the speed of light. Time changes and space changes. It doesn't make sense, but that's the way it is. That took us up to page 5.
And we were lucky to get there.
Next point we're going to be looking at was, why don't I take a minute and just give you a quick survey of quantum physics historically, so you can kind of put this in perspective. I'll start with where we just, let's see, that's some of you. Well, you can get up. Do it.
I'll take good notes.
Okay.
All right. Answer chair.
Just get back in the corner.
Okay, right in the corner.
No, just corner. I'm fine. After by the coffee.
Oh, I see. Okay. I'll scoot back here while you're focused on the last there.
Is that better? Mm-hmm. Everyone see it?
There's some over here.
Thanks.
Uh-huh.
We were talking about Einstein. Einstein wrote two major papers. What I talked about, the relativity of time, was finalized in 1905. That's called the theory of special. This is called the special theory of relativity. This is called the general theory of relativity. This just looks at time and space. This looks at the whole shebang, and particularly gravity. And so this is a smaller version of this. Nothing important. I'm just trying to give you a feeling of the years. Interestingly, he discovered these in Switzerland. Bern. There's an Einstein museum there. You know the history? He was working as a patent clerk. He was just working as a patent clerk to pay the bills.
Mm-hmm. Working on physics in his spare time.
Worked on this in his spare time. This was his hobby. Yeah. Okay. The big date is 1900. And that's Max Planck. We'll be talking about him in a moment. So this is just to give you a survey. Is that too light to read?
Mm-hmm.
Is it too light to read?
Mm-hmm.
German. He's the guy that said the way energy works inside an electron is different than the way energy works in the world as we know it. And we'll be talking about it in a moment. Energy cannot assume just any old value. See, that breaks all laws. I'll come back to that.
this is where it started. Or depending how you count, you could say started in 1895, a guy in England. Lang is discrete units. He discovered the electron. But that's all. They didn't realize that the existence of that electron was going to lead to such complications. But they began to see the complications in 1900 when they realized that in the atom, the energy cannot have just any old value. It can only have specific values. We'll talk more about that. Again, I just mentioned this before, this historical point at the moment, but we will be looking at the implications of that. Really now, for our purposes, the big date is 1911. And this is 1904. No, sorry. 37. It was, I think it was actually in Australia. And Ernest Rutherford, you can read my hard writing. And I waited to make this discovery in England, but then actually he went to Montreal and he taught at McGill, I think, in Montreal. He discovered the nucleus of the atom. And what was so weird there, the atom, you know, I don't remember the exact proportion. Let's say the atom is as big as this room. The nucleus would be the size of a pinhead. To the size of the atom, the nucleus is teeny, 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 teeny. Maybe even orders of magnitude smaller than the pinhead. So the fact that he came upon this thing while shooting little particles into gas was kind of remarkable in itself. But at certain points, they deflected in ways that they wouldn't have deflected if there hadn't been something there. So he posited that there were electrons, that there's a center of the atom, which is so incredibly dense, it almost defies imagination. Now, really for our purposes, Niels Bohr in Copenhagen, created the first quantum theory of the atom. The first. It turned out not to be accurate, but the basic idea was there. And what he found was that this stuff that Max Planck discovered was enormous help in understanding this. So this is the first model, and they continued working on the fact that it seemed to kind of predict what the atom was doing, how they predict that, we'll be talking about too. But it was only in 1927 that the final quantum theory could be shown to accurately predict what was going on in the atom. So he got, you could say, he kind of got the fish up out of the water in 1913, and then that's when Pauli and Bohr and Heisenberg worked together these 14 years, and so they finally got it straight how to refine what he thought the model of the atom was. He's the guy. Bohr is the guy who said that the atom is built like a solar system. The nucleus at the center like the sun. The electrons going around it like planets. But here's what we're dealing with. I just wanted to give you a sense of where that all fit into history, how it became step by step. Okay with that? Now let's look. Now, what I'm going to do now is go back and look at Falk, what Falk said. Because this is where Crowley enters the picture. So Falk is just discovering this. Remember, Crowley was born in 1900. So these discoveries are just being made when Crowley was born. So that the revolution in physics, and this is what really started the revolution in physics, started around 1900, and Crowley then was heir to it. And Planck's discovery was very simple to explain, even not so easy to understand, is that as far as classical physics goes, energy can have any value. Like your car can go, like an accelerated car, you accelerate smoothly. But if you use the analogy of that, it would be like your car would accelerate like this. That should be straight up and down. Energy can only exist in finite values. And they called that that word has changed over time. I think at that time, but they called it Planck's quantum of action. And that turned everything upside down. Have you ever used software where you get a line next to something and it snaps in? That's what this is like. It goes and then it snaps. It goes and then it snaps. It goes and then it snaps. And this is always a predictable and regular value. Nobody knew why. But it contradicts everything. And what is everything? Well, this all started, remember, with Isaac Newton, 1600s. who developed the laws that describe, the mathematical laws that describe the motion of the planets and the motions of things on the Earth, and the laws were applicable to both things happening on Earth and things and planets revolving around the sun. And the basic idea is that things can have any value. There's no explanation for this at that time. Later, what Bohr and Pauli and Heisenberg discovered, you've got an electron circling around a nucleus, and guess what the energy value is of each of these orbits? One times this, two times this, and three times. So that was a linking up of the what they call the discontinuity of energy and the behavior of the electron in the atom. That's the basic point. That's what they all built from in their work. And that took 25 years to get straight.
And Jerry, that's as opposed to any one of those orbital patterns being any value.
Right.
That they're always in relation to each other.
Always in integer relations.
In integer relations.
Integer relations. So you can never have an orbit here. You never can have an orbit here. You never can have an orbit here. And there is no reason why. It just is. So, we're looking at the parallel in paradigm between science and psychology, or science and the way we look at ourselves. This was a major blow to the scientific mind that thought
it could explain everything. At the heart of matter is an inexplicable fact. Why is it that this jump is this big? Why is it the jump this big? Why isn't the jump this big?
It just is.
So reason ran into an unexplainable fact at the very heart of matter.
It is not reasonable. The old physics is reasonable. If you have this, then you have this, and you can explain this on the basis of that. But that doesn't work here anymore. So we have the fact that time is being reevaluated. We have the fact that at the heart of the material world is an irrational fact. It's kind of like it's sticking its tongue out at all those scientists who say the world is reasonable. It's not. So rationality is challenged as well. No dumb questions when it comes to physics.
Why doesn't that fact just then become reasonable? This is now what we know to be reasonable, that this is the way it works. I mean, as we shift and we discover new things, mm-hmm. now that becomes the reasonable way of considering something. Why does it maintain the element of irrationality?
Because there's no way you can explain, I mean, I don't want that number. Say that number is 8.33642. Why isn't that number 8.3 1111? That's the problem. There's no way to explain that value of that number. It's like nature's telling us what the deal is.
So it could be that we just don't have knowledge yet?
It is possible. It is very possible. This, what we're talking about now, is called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. Einstein rejected it. Remember that famous statement, God does not play dice? That's what he was talking about. That this seems to be a random choice of nature for a value which is the basic constant of nature. And where quantum mechanics stops is to say, and that's the way it is. And Einstein said no. There is a regularity and there is a predictability. We just have not yet discovered it yet.
Didn't he work on that the last part?
Yeah, and he didn't succeed.
He did not give up.
We don't know. I can tell you, Pauli thought it was nuts what Einstein was doing. For what it's worth, he thought that Einstein was really caught by the old paradigm and couldn't let it go, and that we are moving into a world where predictability is no longer certain.
Was part of the issue too about whole numbers and half numbers?
Well,
yeah.
Okay. I just go one step at a time, so I don't want anyone throwing up here. And if you got that, we'll go a step further. And somewhere here. Pass these around.
Actually, before you even get started, let me just back up.
Yeah.
Just one quick thing. Part of the non-predictability of it is each number, while it would be fixed within itself, it was always different within each atom you look at, right? Or no, it's always fixed within every...
Well, I see what you're going to. Let me, if you're happy with this, I'll go a step further. how do they figure this out?
I think it helps to know how they figure it out. What they would do is they would heat up a gas. They're supposed to be tonight. They would heat up a gas, and they would get bands of color. You see that one? It's got bands of color.
Mm-hmm.
So the gas, I mean, imagine each of these is a different color. It shows that there's actual picture of the light emitting. Just think of a neon light. That's probably as close as our experience goes. You put electricity through a gas, a neon gas, and it glows. Now, if you took a gizmo that could measure what are the colors of light in that gas, in that neon glow, apart from any paint that might be on the glass, you will get specific bands of color. And they are always the same. They started this, I think, with hydrogen, but I'm not totally sure. And this is called a spectrograph. So that kind of orangey you see coming off of neon, it's made up of some red, some yellow, like a painter would mix colors. But you can break it down to the colors of light in that mixture of light. Yellow, red, probably some blue, some purple. And they have machines that can do it. I mean, machines would be like very, 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 very complicated prisms. Think of how you put a prism up to light, and it breaks it up, right? That's what they would do, except break it up like a gazillion times more accurately. And so they can measure exactly the frequencies or the colors, because frequency of light and the color of light are the same thing. The different colors that would come off of a heated gas. And what they concluded was each of these frequencies was equal to the energy between the nucleus and an orbit. So when an electron, it never goes that low. Between two orbits. So this band of light would be the energy that would contain the energy difference between these two orbits. And this band of light would contain the energy, I'm being simplistic, but would contain the energy value of the distance between these two orbits. And this band of light would contain that energy value. That's how they figured it out. I'm not saying anything new, I just said it in a different way. Does that make sense? And keep that going around there so people can see. There's a picture of a gas heated in a tube, and then the colors that came off of it. And then each color has the energy value of this space between the two orbits. Now that's not so interesting for our purposes, but here's where it starts to get interesting. First of all, for power. What happens if you put this gas in a very strong magnetic field between two big magnets? Instead of getting one line here, you get two very close together. And that really drove for a loop. What Pauli figured out, these electrons aren't just going around this way. They're also orbiting that way. But they're also spinning that way. So they're really like planets. They're going around the sun but they're also rotating on their own axis. In the on this orbit, let's say, this electron, which is going that way, will give you that band of light. And this electron, which is going this way, will give you that band of light. So those single colors that you see in the picture there, they are really, if you put that atom in a strong magnetic field, that single line would split up into two lines. But almost the same color. Probably with the equipment used to take that photograph, it wouldn't show up. It would look mushy. But with very, very sophisticated equipment, it actually they realized this single line splits into two lines. And again, why should you care? Pauli's going to have a dream about this. We'll be talking about that. The word in physics is, this is a doublet. And the other word is that we're dealing with the splitting of, let's say, of color lines for the moment. A little bit. Let me just go a little bit over time before I break so we can keep on this. Still, this isn't the main point. This is all preparatory. This is the main point. If you can visualize one single atom, when you shoot energy in here in the form of heat or whatever to one single atom, and you have an electron here. That electron might go up there. Or it might go here and stop, here and stop, and here and stop. Or it might go from here and stop, and then go here. How do they go? By looking at the colors that are generated or absorbed at each time. Guess what? You can never, ever predict where it's going to go. You cannot say it's going to go here this time, and here next time, and here next time. It may go here three times, and then they go here once. Or maybe here once, and here twice, and here once. So you see, predictability, this is the big point, predictability at the atomic level stops. That's what quantum physics is. Quantum physics, quantum is that, taken from that word, that small amount, plus quantum of effect. Quantum physics says you can't predict what goes on in an atom. You can only show statistically what are the probabilities of that electron's moving. And that's what Einstein could not accept. See, again, every time there's a movement in Einstein's mind, that's a roll of the dice by God. And Pauli and the quantum Copenhagen people would say, sorry, that's the way it is. We cannot know anything beyond this. This is the limit of our knowledge. Because nature herself is unknowable, finally. You see the shift in looking at stuff. Time has broken down. Causality has broken down. Certainty has broken down. Objectivity has broken down. Everything starts to go up for grabs within 25 years in science. And nothing of Jungian psychology. Who cares about being certain? We don't try to predict things. We don't see ourselves as objective. We take as one of the fundamental constituents of life synchronicity, which is unpredictable and unknowable in the causal sense.
So the old paradigm of certainty and predictability and objectivity and control is being evaporated, at least in theory. This is what Pauli was born into. And that means it's break time.